to start the last section in the book of Judges. If you recall, I said when we began, Judges is broken up into three sections, and last week we finished the second section, concluded with chapter 16. The second section was the section in Judges that it's one cycle after the other. We're introduced to 12 judges, and last week Samson we saw was the last judge. And this week with chapter 17 and 18, one guy described it like this. It's like reading chapter 17 and 18, you can tell that it's different. It's a different, and he described it as, it's like you've been walking down a paved road, and then all of a sudden you look down and you're standing on a gravel road. It's clearly a distinction that's taken place between verses 16 and 17 at the end of Samson's life. What we're going to find is that the story of Judges, the book of Judges, ends with two very interesting stories, to say the least. In fact, I would encourage you, if you haven't read ahead, I would encourage you to go ahead and read next week's lesson, next week's chapters before you come in. There will be chapters 19, 20, and 21. I'm sure that they will arouse some interest. Chapter 17 and 18 is what is on tap this morning. At the very beginning of chapter 17, we are introduced to a man in our story named Micah. We're told that Micah lived in the hill country of Ephraim. And one day, we're told of this man Micah and how he went to his mother and he said something like this, Mom, do you remember that 1,100 pieces of silver that went missing from you? You know that I'm talking about, because I remember you were so upset that I heard you pronounce a curse on whomever it was that took it. Well, Mom, I know what happened to your silver. I took it. Perhaps not sure how his mom would respond. He was probably surprised when she immediately reversed the curse that she had pronounced and turned it into a blessing. She responded like this, "Well, the Lord bless you, son, for telling me the truth." And she was thankful. She said, "And well, Micah returned all the 1,100 pieces of silver." Let me pause and say, I'm not sure if there's any connection or not, but I find it interesting. In the chapter before, we also encountered 1,100 pieces of silver with what was Delilah's wage for tricking Samson. Some people have argued, I don't think it's the case, but some have argued, we're dealing with Delilah here, covertly. I'm not sure that's the case, but I'll carry on anyway. Just make the connection. The connections with Samson's story will continue as we go. But she says, well, I'm so thankful that you've given me this 1,100 pieces of silver back. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to dedicate it to the Lord. 1,100 pieces of silver. I'm going to give you 200 pieces of it. And I'm going to take it to the silversmith. And Micah, I'm going to have him to melt it down and form an idol out of it so that you can set this idol up and you're in the shrine that you have at your house. And that's what she did. Silversmith constructed an idol, and this household god would stay in the home of Micah. One quick note about this character named Micah before we go any further that will prove to be significant is that the name of Micah actually means who is like Yahweh. So, as we read the story about this man who has these idols and images, remember, the owner of these is a man whose name means who is like Yahweh. Now, we need to make sure we understand who this Micah is before we go on any further. We don't let the fact that he just got caught stealing from his mom lead you astray in your mind. Micah was a deeply religious man. He has a shrine. We're told he has an ephod. We're told that he has household gods. We're told that he ordained some of his sons to be priests. Micah was no godless hoodlum. He was a religious hoodlum. And just so that the reader might know how to interpret what has just happened, the narrator gives us a clue as to how to interpret all of this idol talk and shrine talk and priest talk when he says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes." And from there, the story takes us into the introduction of another man. We aren't given this man's name right now, but we're told that he was a young man from Bethlehem of Judah, that he was a Levite sojourner looking for a new place to settle down and live. And while he was wandering, looking for a new place to live, he wandered into the country of the hill country of Ephraim, into the house of no other than the house of Micah, the religious man. And as Micah and the Levite were getting to know one another better, Micah asked the Levite, "Where do you come from?" And the Levite told Micah that he was from Bethlehem of Judah and that he was looking to change addresses. I'm sure Micah, this religious man, could hardly believe what he was hearing. It must have only served as a confirmation of the thing that Micah had already thought. The Lord must be pretty pleased with me. I mean, he's given me these idols, the shrine, and now he sent me my very own Levite. Now I can stop pretending that my sons are something that they're not. It must be a gift from God because he just keeps opening up all these doors. And if he didn't want me to have a Levite for my very own, he wouldn't have sent this one to me. So he had a proposal for the Levite. "Why don't you settle here? I'll give you 10 pieces of silver a year." That gives us a little bit of a hint into how much 1,100 pieces of silver is worth. If he's willing to pay a yearly wage of 10 pieces of silver a year, "I'll give you a new suit, plus I'll give you your living expenses." The Levite was blown away. I'm sure he thought something like this: "Where God guides, he provides." He accepted. Micah ordained him as priest, and the Levite became the priest of Micah's home. He was content to dwell in the hill country of Ephraim. And it says that the Levite became like a son to him. Now, the reason that's not standing out to you just yet is because I skipped over one of the things that Micah told the Levite. When he was inviting him to come, he invited him, "Come and you'll be like a father to me." And then by the end of the paragraph, we found the Levite came and he was like a son to him. At this point in the story, the writer wants to go ahead and convey something to us. This religiosity, if you will, of Micah isn't going to deliver on its promises. It's not going to satisfy Micah's longing. It's not going to scratch his itch. Micah wanted a patriarch. He wanted a father figure. "Come and be a father to me." But what Micah gets is another dependent, a son. It's really the first switch, if you will, that we find in this story. Micah idolatrously hoped what he hoped for, and got exactly the opposite. He wanted a father. He got what would be a son. But from his point of reference, from the way he thought about the world, Micah tells us one thing that he's certain of: the Lord is going to bless me now. Surely the Lord is going to bless me now. But what we're going to find is that he was wrong. In fact, what we know, or what we're about to discover, is that Micah is standing on the edge of a bluff, a gulf, if you will. For we've already come to a major turning point in the development of the plot. Micah's personal fortune, which have steadily risen throughout this chapter, these first two episodes, are about to undergo a sudden reversal. Notice from now on, as we read through the story, nothing else is going to go Micah's way. It's a moment of finest mockery, as one man said. But as we will see, this is always true of our attempts of religion when we try to manipulate God. And then chapter 18, verse 1, the writer wants to communicate that what's about to take place still must be seen as a result of the fact that there's no king in Israel. In those days, there was no king in Israel. He says it again. He also tells us that in those days, the tribe of Dan was seeking a place of their own. So why were the Danites still homeless? Well, it was because while all the other tribes had at least partly fulfilled God's command for them to go in and fight courageously and drive out the Canaanites and take over their God-given inheritance, Dan had failed. And if you recall back in chapter 1, at the end of chapter 1, we noted several weeks ago that once we got to the tribe of Dan and talking about how they didn't go in and conquer the land, they weren't even allowed to live in the land. The people of the land made them stay up in the hill country. They made them live in the mountains. So the Danites never took over the land. They failed in their military obligation, and they were confined to the hill country. The Danites didn't even get into their land, but were forced to live in the mountains. So now they're in search for a land that they can settle and plant and grow and eat their crops. But instead of taking the land that God told them to take, that he allotted for them, they wanted a piece of land that they could take on their own strength, where they didn't need to rely on God. So the tribe of Dan have a tribal meeting, and they devised a plan. Let's send out 5 able-bodied men from Zorah and Ashtaroth. Another significant thing is we're just told at the end of chapter 16 and early in chapter when we introduced to Samson, this is the place where Samson is from. So we're these two men, the 5 men from Zorah and Ashtaroth, and they say, we're going to send these men out to be spies to explore and see what's out there. Now, upon their expedition, these men came to the hill country of Ephraim, where Micah's house was located. And we're told that these 5 men were allowed to lodge there. While they were there, we're told that they were able to recognize the Levite's voice. Now, it probably means one of two things. Either somehow their paths had crossed this particular Levite's path early on in their life and they were able to recognize his voice, or probably more likely they realized that this guy's accent wasn't from the hill country of Ephraim and it sounded more like he was from Judah. So either way they have a question for him. What brought you here, and what is your business here? The Levite told the men all about his deal with Micah, how he had become Micah's own personal priest. The men, hearing that he was a priest, asked him to inquire on their behalf as to whether or not their trip will be a success. The Levite did. He did whatever it is that a priest would do and told them to go in peace and assured them that they were indeed under the eye of God. Under the eye of the Lord is what he specifically says. So the 5 men depart. They leave Micah's house and they come to the city called Laish. And in Laish they saw a people who, it said, was living securely. They said that they were an unsuspecting people. He said that the lives of these people resembled those of the Sidonians. It said that they lacked for no good thing. Perhaps, best of all, they were secluded. They were so far away from any other group of people that nobody's going to be able to come and help defend them. So the five men returned back to their home from which they had initially been sent out. And when they were asked, they gave a full report concerning the city of Laish. They told them it was a good piece of land. People there are lacking for nothing. It's spacious. They dwell securely. Being attacked is the farthest thing from their minds. And they're so far away that no one's going to be able to come and help defend them. And they say, "Oh, brothers, don't be afraid to go up. Can't you see that God is giving them into your hands?" So the Danites up and armed for action. They were ready. 600 Danite men took up arms and were mobilized. As the march begins, they first come to Kiriath-Jearim in Judah. They encamp there for a bit, and then from there, they continue up through the hill country of Ephraim. It's at this point where the five spies, it appears from the story that the five spies up until this point had not told them about Micah's house or the Levite priest that they had met. But when they come through the hill country, the five spies remember, and they say they tell the others about Micah's house, his religious paraphernalia, and about the priest and how the priest gave them a favorable report or forecast. Upon hearing this, they decide that they're going to make a slight detour on the way to Laish. And it was decided that these five men would go to Micah's house, take all the religious objects, including the priest, while the 600 waited at the entrance of the gate of the property. The men inside Micah's house began collecting the idols and the images, and at some point, the priest walks in and asks them, what are you doing? They order him to be quiet, cover his mouth, and then they give him a business proposition. They say, "Is it better for you to be the priest of one man or the priest of a whole tribe?" It didn't take long for the Levite to run the calculations. And the narrator tells us that the Levite's heart was glad. A man motivated by self-promotion. He served as priest on behalf of Micah, but he really served himself. Just notice that what type of priest he is. He will serve whoever pays him. He'll tell people what they want to hear, and then he'll move on to more impressive things. He's driven by self-interest. And now, and notice how each decision that he makes in the story takes him further from the Lord. He began as a Levite in the town of Bethlehem of Judah, the foremost tribe. He moved on to the hill country of Ephraim to an idolatrous shrine. Finally, he ends up in Laish, outside of the land that God gave his people, working for a tribe who wouldn't even make it to heaven. But leaving Micah's house, the 600 set out again towards Laish. The children, we're told that the children and the livestock were put in the front. Not because the men weren't great leaders, but because they were sort of expecting that when Micah came in and find that he had been robbed, that perhaps he may pursue them. And they didn't want their children and the livestock at the very back. And they were right. At some point, Micah discovers that all he had to live for had been stolen. He did the very thing. He pursued them. He pursued the Danites, and when he overtook them, he began yelling and crying out to them. And finally, the Danites responded and said, "What is the matter with you? Why are you pursuing us?" And he said, "You took my idols, images, and priests, and left me with nothing." Now, to read it in the original reveals to us more clearly the heart of Micah. It shows beyond doubt what his words are emphasizing. They're the first thing that he mentions. I'll read it to you in exactly the way the word order is. But they're the very first thing he mentions. And notice the threefold use of the first person expression when he says, this is how it reads, "My gods, which I made for myself, you have taken." My gods, which I made for myself, you have taken. The Danites had a quick counseling session with Micah in which they offered him free advice. "You better turn around and get out of here before some of us get angry and kill you." Micah, too, quickly did the calculations and came to the conclusion that the 600 Danites were too strong for him, so he turned around and went home. The Danites have no sympathy for Micah. They have no intention of giving him what he wants, but neither do they want to kill him. I mean, after all, he is a fellow Israelite. But they do want to get rid of him. So they respond to his question, "What do I have left?" by pointing out the fact, well, at least you still have your life, but warn him that he's in danger of losing even that if he doesn't cease and desist, as well as the lives of the men with him. It's one man pointed out that the way that they respond to him is sort of a way of saying something like, "There are some angry people up here ahead of us, and if word gets to them that you're bothering us, there's no telling what they might do." Sort of somehow threaten him while at the same time being able to escape a responsibility. Remember, these bullies are the same people who wouldn't take their own land, and they're going to beat up unsuspecting people, might I add. Micah left and went home. But remember how Micah's story started in chapter 17 with his confession to his mom that he had stolen her silver. And it ends here with him having to accept that the Danites have stolen his silver. There's no specific reference to the Lord here, but there is definitely some poetic justice going on. The robber gets robbed. Micah gets what he deserves. And as we continue on, we're going to see that this pattern continues with the Danites as well. The Danites went to Laish. They found the city just as the spies had reported. Things were quiet. In fact, the people of Laish didn't even know what hit them. They suspected nothing. The Danites attacked them. They put them to the sword, and they burned their city down with fire. And just as they thought, no one came to deliver them. But make no mistake about it, the conquering of Laish, by conquering Laish, Dan has not contributed to Israel's conquest of Canaan at all, but has only served to contribute to Canaan's conquest of Israel. Because, as we're told at the end, it's not the Lord who's going to be worshipped in this new city called Dan, but it's Micah's idols that are set up there. After destroying Laish, they built it back. They called the new city Dan. They set up the images and the idols. And finally, the author wanted waited until the very last point of the story to reveal to us the name of this Levite. It tells us his name is Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. The son of Moses. How far we've fallen. I'll hit pause and say, if you're looking at a King James, it says Manasseh. Ask me later and I'll tell you why. I wasn't going to say that, so I made me lose my train of thought. I saw Art's head look over to Juanita's Bible to make sure that his wasn't wrong. Didn't you? Yeah. The revelation of his name and ancestry of Micah's Levite in verse 30 comes as a complete surprise. Now, I know what I was going to say. It's likely that Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, isn't the third generation. It's possible that it's a few down, but he's wanting to make the connection. This is someone who's related to the great Moses here. But this revelation comes as a surprise. It's almost certainly withheld for this very point to achieve this effect. The bad character has been too clearly established at this point for him to be redeemed. In fact, it likely does just the opposite. Instead of dropping the name Moses to make him think, oh, it must not have been that bad if it was Moses' descendant that did it. Instead, it just brings dishonor even to the name of Moses. The story ends with a final bit of information. And we're told that his sons served as priests in Dan until the land was conquered. Okay? Served as priests until the land was conquered. So they set up Micah's carved image that was made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. So two pieces of information right here that should catch our attention. The first one mentions the fact that the land was conquered, which would have been hundreds of years after this was written, after these things took place. So the thing I would tell you is that it's likely there was still some editing taking place when even after David had become king. But in view of this statement about the Levites' ancestry in verse 30 and how they stayed there until the land was conquered, it sort of points us back, if you will, to Micah's confident statement in chapter 17, verse 13. If you recall, now I know the Lord will treat me well because the Levite has become my priest. It's like everything else in this narrative. It's meant to be irony. It's meant to lead us to disaster. Because the Danites have committed Micah's sin, and they're going to suffer the same consequences. You recall, the robber got robbed. And with this bit of information, we're told that, again, the Danites, the robbers, get robbed. Their shrine gets robbed, making this judgment inevitable. The second thing we notice is that the story ends with a reference to the house of God at Shiloh, which is meant to stand in contradiction, because throughout the whole story we keep pointed back to the house of Micah's God, the house of Micah's God. And now we hear the house of God at Shiloh. It was the place established by God to be the place of worship. It was in Shiloh where the tabernacle was erected. It was in Shiloh where God would meet with the people. You see, Shiloh was right in God's eyes. But it's another generation that has only a vague awareness of where it came from. They're no longer anchored securely to its gospel foundations. They don't remember who they are. It shows two things. It shows us how people behave when they're still religious, but no longer remember how they came upon their relationship with God. They do whatever is right in their own eyes. But it also does something else. It shows us the trajectory of man-made religions in our lives. It shows us how far we will go. It shows us the direction that we're going in when we seek to please God by our own religious initiatives. And in the end, it teaches us that the Pharisee, the religious Pharisee, is no better than the prostitute. When we think in our day, when we hear the word, they did what was right in their own eyes, we tend to think of the context, when we liken that to our, so many of you have come to me during this thing and says, oh, we're just like Israel, or we're just like they were. We're a culture who does what's right in their own eyes. We tend to think of it as people who just, they live by no laws at all, people who are completely mindless of religion, if you will. And I think that's right. I think that it could be said. But in our context, these were very religious people that we're talking about here who were right in their own eyes. But it's always the case when we try to tilt the scales of God's favor to our advantage by checking off the good Christian boxes. At the end of the day, we're only running 2.0 version of Micah's original program. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of reasons why living what God's Word teaches and describes for us is smart and wholesome and healthy. It's the best way to go about life. Fearing and worshiping Him in our grateful obedience is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But doing it to attract God's attention, like Micah, or to get on his good side, is not one of those good reasons. It's not a toggle switch that releases for us even one blessing. It's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. And to believe, yeah. Micah's story teaches us that religion doesn't work. Trying to earn God's pleasure just won't ever work. And yet, we have to be honest, it goes on all the time, all over the place, all around us. We see a system of thought where people perform certain acts or rites or scheduled ceremonies, hoping to keep their account paid up so that one day they can turn them in for a final redemption. Cashing in their chips, if you will. And it's so silly that these list of things, especially when they become the way that people who are saved by grace, Christians, try relating to God. And they're so slippery in the way that they slip into our lives. But the tilting the scales stuff is based upon the idea that it's good little boys and girls that are the ones that get to go to heaven. But in reality, it's bad little boys and girls that are transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ who go to heaven. It's people whose sins are covered by His redeeming work and who love Him so much that now they flesh out these new desires that He's placed within them by willingly loving and worshiping Him. not to buy their way in, but to celebrate the fact that they are in. Because we can't be redeemed by our own religious works. Micah needed something more. He wanted a spiritual father. But since he didn't know the Lord, his religion left him with nothing. It highlights the emptiness and worthlessness of idolatry. Idolaters are floating. They're justifying their biblical critiques, and they rationalize apart from just coming to know God. But, brothers and sisters, God isn't like the Danites. He doesn't come and take away our valuables and leave us with nothing. He comes and he reveals to us and he offers to us the greatest riches of all. And we find that even in our story. We see it hinted at even in our story. We find out what God's antidote, his solution, his redemption is for this corruption that we've been reading about. He offers us the solution to this madness and to this confusion we find in the story. To this type of religiosity that we find from Micah, from his idols, from his images. And for one moment, I want to address the theologically savvy among us. If you don't know what I'm, if I'm about to use words that you don't understand, then I'm not talking to you. Let not your heart be troubled. As Jesus and Pastor Carol would say. When we read of the problem, when we read of this false worship taking place, and I say that we know the solution. If in your mind you're thinking, yes, we do know the solution. The regulative principle of worship is the solution. If they would have had a better understanding of the regulative principle, all of this worship wouldn't have happened. But I'll tell you, I don't think that's what the writer has in mind at all. He's not suggesting the antidote, the solution for false religion is not another rule. It's not more law that we need. His argument is this: if Israel only had a king, not just any king, but the right kind of king, he would have put a stop to all of this madness, to this nonsense. In short, the idea is proper covenantal control ought to stifle false religion. But we have to ask, what king ever did this? I mean, I have to stop and say, this view that the writer of Judges has about kingship is interesting, right? Because he keeps offering up this idea of, well, they didn't have a king. That's why they're doing these things. Back then, they didn't have a king. Offering up this hopeful suggestion of, if we, even putting it in the hearts of the people, this longing, this hope of, oh, if we had a king, things would be different. But as we step back and we look at throughout the history of Israel, we see the kings led the people into this sort of thing. So I wanted to say all that to say, I think again, this gives us a hint as to when this book was written, primarily written. I alluded that there were some editors. I would say it shows us that it was definitely written before the end of Solomon's life, because what person could have written it after Solomon and the division of the kingdom and seen a king as the obvious answer? They wouldn't have. This was still when they were looking at the king, saying, ah, a king is what we need, a king. And I would tell you that the writer of Judges wholeheartedly agreed a king was the answer. Now, David is probably the clearest portrait, the best shadow, if you will, for the type of king that Israel was looking for. But even David didn't do it perfectly. He got sidetracked. He had setbacks. So I say, what king did completely do as the text suggests? What king leads Israel into what is right before God? And I think you know the answer. Who is Jesus Christ if he is not our king? Who is Jesus Christ if he is not the King of Kings? Without him, we fall into all sort of religious and political chaos. But with Christ as the Lord of the church, his people are sanctified and they're focused on the task at hand of fulfilling the Great Commission. Micah's name meant, who is like Yahweh? Jesus is like Yahweh. And even his name is God with us, Emmanuel. Paul tells us that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He fulfills the tabernacle at Shiloh. He is the true sanctuary of God in the flesh. He was born in Bethlehem that fulfills all of the point and fulfills the story that points to David by identifying himself with the city of David where the Lord was served aright. Jesus is the one from Bethlehem who will minister before the true God in such a way as to free his people from the folly of and idolatry which entangles them and rescue us from God's curse and punishment. The antidote of this sort of thing is to actually know and worship the King, because many deceive themselves and just don't know any better or don't know any better. And in this respect, the era of the judges that we're reading is so much like what we live in today. Everyone does what's right in his own eyes, inventing this God to follow or that God to follow, and it leaves people empty and it leaves people lost. But the solution today is exactly the same solution that the writer of Judges held up so many years ago. Such people, we need a king. We need a king. And it's through this king that God has made it possible for people to approach him, to worship him, to know him, to live with him. The tabernacle, the place of God's presence among his people, was in Shiloh, and it should have been the focal point for Micah and for the Danites. And so should God's tabernacle be for us even today. The man who is literally the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. If we don't center our lives on Jesus, then the way to approach God and worship God and know God and live with God, then the only alternative is to center it upon a man-made religion, upon an idol, upon something that cannot bless. But when we find Jesus, we find blessing. But we only truly experience his blessing when we say to him, Jesus, without you, what else do I have? You are my everything. We have to realize that there is nowhere else to go in life, and that there is no need to go elsewhere in life. If we know Jesus is ultimately all we have, we will discover that he is eternally all we'll ever need. Jesus is the perfect king to take away, to do away with false worship. He's the perfect king to crush all of our idols to the dust. Not because he comes to you with a heavy hand, but because he comes to you with a full heart. A full heart of love and a full heart of compassion and a full heart of sympathy. He wants you to come to him. Christians, his invitation to you every day is to come to him. It's about coming before his throne every day. Every day the invitation is renewed. Every day he's offering you to come and to give your life again and again and again to King Jesus. And maybe you hear this sort of thing for the first time. You hear of this king for the first time, or maybe I should say you feel him for the first time, and you feel his invitation, and you feel him beckoning you, and you feel him calling you to himself. Then I would tell you, he is exactly the type of king that will not disappoint you, that you can put all of your hope in this king. He knows what you've done, but yet he fails to hold it against you. Won't you come to this type of king? Won't you open your heart to this type of king? He invites you. Won't you welcome him to sit on your throne, the throne of your heart and the throne of your life? He wants to be your king. Would you pray with me? Father, we feel the problem. We know the problem. We feel the corruption all too well. It's so deep inside of us, and all of our attempts to rid ourselves of it have only caused us to feel more and more desperate. And Father, perhaps some of us don't even feel it. Lord, would you open our eyes today to the beauty of Jesus Christ? Would you convince us again that his heart is full of love, that his heart is full of compassion, that he's able to sympathize with us? He knows our weaknesses, and yet he doesn't hold it against us. Father, I would ask that you would help us even today. Help us to have hearts, Lord, that are warmed by the thoughts of such a king. That it would be our joy, that we could think of nothing better than to become his subjects. For to become the subjects of Jesus Christ is to become the Son of God, sons and daughters of God, to join him in his inheritance. Thank you. Thank you, Father, for the remedy. Thank you for redemption that's found in Jesus. Thank you that the things that were hinted in centuries past have been revealed to us. Help us to respond appropriately. Amen.